Welcome to This Is Money Podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and Simon Lambert today is Sam Barker. And coming up, with the state pensions set for another big boost next April, questions are being asked, and you, how long can we afford to keep the triple lock for? Facebook Marketplace has become a scammer's paradise. This Is Money found out just how easy it was for criminals. Also today, Santander pulls its Best Buy Easy Access account a week early, but of course you knew that because you'll have signed up to This Is Money savings alerts. And I want to get on the property ladder and have you 40 homes. Not me, but can you help a reader make up their mind? What do our experts suggest? Don't forget to stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Don't forget, you can stay on top of what's going on in the markets by tuning in to the Digest and Invest podcast by eToro. Go to your regular podcast platform and listen on the go. Digest and Invest by eToro, the podcast for those interested in trading and investing.
But first, it looks like retirees are set for another big boost to the state pension next April, following on from the 10.1% rise this year. An increase of at least 8.5% is on the cards. Well, it looks to be. It's after the latest wage figures show a decent rise in earnings, one of the locks of the triple lock mechanism that the state pension rises by each year. But can we as a country afford this? Should the triple lock be ditched altogether, become a single, perhaps a double lock? What is the answer? And who is brave enough to change it? A very warm welcome, Simon. Warm welcome, Sam. Firstly, a bit of a quick recap. The triple lock, how does it work? Why was it brought in? And why, Simon, is everybody talking about it this week?
The triple lock, for anybody who has been asleep under a rock for the past 13 years, is the policy by which we operate the state pension. And it was brought in under the Conservative Liberal Democrat coalition government in order to deal with a problem whereby there had been minimal or pitiful state pension increases. Cast your mind back to the low inflation years of the early 2000s, and sometimes the state pension would rise by an amount that resulted in maybe, you know, £1 a week or something like that. And there would be all these headlines, and then it would be saying about how mean our pension was compared to other people's pensions around the world, which it's not the greatest pension in terms of replacing income, which is the best way to measure a pension. But you have to bear in mind that our state pension system is just the state pension, whereas a lot of other countries' state pension systems are rolled up with their employment pensions as well. So France, for example, is a very, very different system. So whilst France's state pension appears much more generous, it's not quite comparable.
Well, you sort of addressed it, but I just want to say that whenever we read articles about this, it does say that the UK's is one of the worst in the world, and they're doing it on what you say is slightly wrong calculations. So where would you place us if we're not one of the worst in the world? Is it sort of middle, doing well?
I think we're knocking around my understanding is that we're knocking around, if you look at comparable countries, we are knocking around just below the middle mark.
Right.
Okay. Just below mid-table. So
B minus.
Very unlikely that we're going to be able to put in the kind of run that we'll see us playing in the Champions League, but we're probably not going to get relegated either. We will keep the fans broadly happy, but there will be quite a lot of grumbling that we could really, with a bit more effort and a bit more flair, be performing considerably better, which is where the triple lock came in to cut back with a wonderful segue. The triple lock raises the state pension by the highest amount of either average wages, CPI inflation, or 2.5%. That 2.5% backstop is the important bit. It means it will always go up by at least 2.5%. Now, in the low inflation years post-financial crisis, when Britain had broadly stagnant wages, broadly low inflation, the triple lock wasn't really that much of a problem. We didn't debate it that much, but stuff's gone a bit nuts over the last few years. Again, for anybody who's been living under a rock and hasn't noticed, and the triple lock has become quite a troublesome policy. It's also, even in the years when it wasn't a troublesome policy due to spiking wage figures and spiking inflation, quite an expensive policy. But importantly, what it has done is improved the state pension as a measure of how much of the average income it replaces. But even then, I think the figure that was quoted is it's roughly a quarter. Although actually, you know, when you look at the average wage figure of, which is just like, I think it's about £35,000. And then you look at the state pension under the triple lock, that's definitely more than a quarter.
Mm. Sam, when you look at the figures, you think, what is it, about £10,600 a year? That's certainly not enough to live on. A rise of 10%, that looks a bit juicier. But actually, how much is this costing us? What is the overall cost? What could this be? And I appreciate that given the fact that we don't know which lock it's going to go up by, that's if the triple lock stays, that's quite a hard question to answer. But I think we've got some sort of rough estimates of what this could be costing us.
Yeah, we do. So there's around 12.6 million people currently get the state pension. So around one in five people in the UK. And the bill this year for that is expected to be 124 billion. The best estimate is that next year that will rise to 135 billion with that 8.5% increase. And the only way, I mean, that 8.5% increase is almost nailed on. The only way that won't happen is if there's some massive spike in inflation for September of this year, which we would find out, you know, in late October. So it is a massive bill. And look, there are some people for who, you know, the state pension is all they've got. They don't have a private pension. So big increases to the state pension for them are incredibly important. And my heart goes out to those people. But yeah, I think that there's quite a few questions around, you know, should we keep the triple lock in its current form? And that bracket of people need additional government support. But there's an awful lot of people that don't, I think.
It's, as you rightly pointed out, Sam, a very politically hot potato, isn't it? I think economists, Treasury, anyone who's involved in sort of doling out government money is concerned about this. But it seems like This Is Money readers are very concerned about the idea that it would be taken away. Very popular with your readers. I mean, it's going to be very, very difficult, isn't it, down the line. We're arguing to younger workers who are paying into this that, okay, it's fine because you'll reap the rewards when you're older, but will it still be there when they're older?
We've got two views on this. I think I'm a bit more hardline than Simon. So we'll go bad cop first. Is it affordable? Yes, but at what cost? The introduction of the triple lock made the state pension the most generous benefit in the country in terms of how much it will rise every year. Because as Simon says, you get not just one, but three ways in which it can go up. So yeah, the highest of 2.5% earnings growth in the 3 months to July of the year before and inflation in September of the year before. It was an incredibly generous thing to bring in, and it's created a rod really for the backs of successive governments since. You know, one in five people get it. That's an enormous voting block. And the triple lock has become just absolutely something. The Conservatives and Labour have both pledged allegiance to the triple lock for next year, although it does now look like there could be a bit of watering down of that increase by the Conservatives, but we're still kind of waiting for the detail on that. But what I would do is say, well, look, the state pension is a benefit. Compare it to other benefits. Every other benefit, which rises every year, rises just with inflation. So that's things like universal credit, personal independence payment, probably better known as PIP, carers allowance, income support, housing benefit, job seekers allowance, all inflation linked. And that seems fair, right? There's not a significant group of people arguing that an inflation-linked rise to those benefits is not enough. Now, many of those benefits are not high enough in the first place, I would argue, or are uncaring in other ways. But when we just talk about yearly rises, millions of Britons are very happy with inflation-linked rises. Thank you very much. As to whether, you know, the state pension triple lock is affordable long-term, a lot of think tanks and economists say, well, no, it's not. And if we insist on sticking to it, the easy solution for government is to just keep making hikes to the state pension age, which somehow doesn't get people so annoyed as the idea of watering down or scrapping the triple lock. So that is bad news all round, but it's particularly bad for people working manual jobs for whom working into their late 60s is not an option. Now, it does also mean a raw deal for workers currently. So people getting the state pension, that is paid for by workers currently in the system. So I'm a worker, I'm currently in the system. So my national insurance contributions are going towards the state pension of people who are currently retired. So when I argue for basically it to be kind of watered down and made a mono lock, I suppose, I'm basically arguing myself out of some of the increases that I would get were the triple lock to exist when I retire. But I think that that is the fair and affordable thing to do, especially when the public finances are in the state they're in.
So, Simon, that's the bad cop view. I mean, I could go even badder and say, just make it means tested, no?
You could do, but then you're going to talk yourself out of getting a state pension once you hit 60, whatever. So I wouldn't recommend doing that.
I'm not saying I agree.
Yeah. I mean,
well, this is the thing, it's vested interests. Isn't that the point of the benefit system?
I would be very careful about talking yourself out of getting a state pension. It is what I would say to anybody who talks about means testing the state pension. I would be very careful in any form of intergenerational argument where people get involved and look at the grass on the other side and think it's greener and start suggesting that the people on that much greener side should start having their grass cut a bit more. Because quite often they forget that at some point they'll end up living on that side of the garden and they're doing themselves out of something. And they're doing themselves out of a benefit that a generation before them had. And there's already an awful lot of stuff that the older generation have benefited from that the younger working generation haven't benefited from. So I'd be very careful about lines of thinking that involve taking that stuff off you. And actually, there's a very strong case for universal benefits. The case for universal benefits, i.e. a benefit that everyone gets, not means tested, is that it creates a much broader base of support for it. And it means that those people who are more comfortably off and are more able to pay for it, pay the taxes that go to fund those benefits, and don't need that money, are much more supportive of maintaining those benefits and making sure that those benefits actually are meaningful. And a classic universal benefit that was removed was child benefit. Used to be everybody got child benefit. I mean, there's a very simple argument for not giving people with who are high earners child benefit. The answer is, you know, they can afford their children. But when everybody got child benefit, most people supported it, and it was a cornerstone. It was something everybody got that it had children, went towards the children, you know, obviously it didn't, it just went into the household budget, but it was something that everybody with children got, and there was support for it. And the removal of the child benefit has caused all kinds of problems that wouldn't have existed if it had still been there. Now, I mean, ultimately, it's probably saved some money, but, you know, it knocks another brick out the bottom of supporting benefits for people. The pension is obviously much, much more important. The reason why so many of our readers support the triple lock is because many of our readers on This Is Money are getting triple lock uprated pensions. And as far as they are concerned, they worked all of their lives, they paid in, and now they're getting what they're due. Now, there is obviously this this misguided notion, maybe, that people think that the national insurance they paid in that came out of their wages has gone towards a pot that pays their state pension. That's not how it works. The people working now pay the pension of the people who are retired. But you have to go back to the principle of the triple lock and say, well, what was it trying to do? Well, it was trying to make the pension better than it was, which was not very good, really. You know, we weren't aspiring, as I said, to Champions League status at the time. We were just about avoiding relegation, and to make sure that people got meaningful rises. So then you go, okay, well, was that a clear enough purpose? It sort of probably seemed like it at the time, but then you look at the details and you go, well, what's it actually trying to do? Which one of these three things do we think is best here? Is it 2.5%? Is it just that there's a backstop? Why 2.5%? Why did we pick 2.5%? Why didn't we pick 2%, which is the inflation target? Or is it wages? Do we think that the pension is replacement income? Therefore, it should go up by the same amount as the average wage goes up. Should we include bonuses in that? Because that total wages figure includes bonuses. So there's an argument at the moment about the way the government might wriggle out part of the triple lock is by removing the bonuses element and paying 7.8% instead of 8.5%, because one-off bonuses to public sector, NHS workers, etc., over the summer have skewed the figures. So there's another problem with the triple lock, is we've managed to use a figure that is quite troublesome, okay, this wages figure, which I'll come back to in a minute, or do we think that the pension should just go up by inflation so people don't get poorer in real terms? I mean, that's quite an obvious and clear aim. So maybe we should just uprate it by inflation, as Sam said. Instead, we've ended up with this hodgepodge, which was okay when the numbers weren't so big. But as things have gone slightly nuts, it's caused a bit of a problem. So firstly, we had the supposedly one-off event caused by the once-in-a-lifetime pandemic, where there was a spike in wages, where people coming back off furlough and returning back to work warped the numbers. So there was an 8.6% rise in wages. But economists were broadly agreed, actually, people's wages were not rising by that much. There was a problem with the figures. Now, it would have been a good idea to realise that you were dealing with problematic figures before you introduced a policy that uprated everybody's pension based on them. But lo and behold, something popped up that we hadn't planned for. Unusual event in Britain. I do realise that. Stuff does happen that we haven't planned for. So we broke the triple lock that year and we gave people 3.1%, which was inflation instead. Unfortunately, hot on the heels of that one-off event came an inflation spike the next year. And last year, the inflation reading was 10.1%. So then there was a big argument about, whoa, hang on, there's this massive inflation spike. We can't be uprating pensions by 10.1%. It's not fair because wages aren't failing to match inflation. So can we really expect workers to pay for pensioners to get a rise that matches inflation? On the flip side, others pointed out that the government had made a promise. The ideal thing with promises is that you stick to them. And if you've broken them once, then you definitely make sure you stick to them next time. And maybe if they'd have kept it last time, they could have broken it this time. But actually, they've ended up shooting themselves in the foot and costing themselves money. And Liz Truss, having delivered her masterful mini budget alongside Kwasi Kwarteng, decided in her wisdom that it wouldn't be a great idea to break the triple lock. And even stern school teacher Jeremy Hunt, who arrived with the fun police to mop up Liz Truss's mess and raise taxes for everyone, wasn't quite daft enough to tell pensioners they weren't going to get their inflation rated rise. So they got the 10.1%. You'd think that that would have, like, just, you know, okay, nailed it down. We're nearing an election. Clearly, you're not going to break the triple lock again. And let's just stop arguing about it. But we're arguing about it again this year with the wages figure. As I pointed out, there's this question of bonuses. And there's this, well, hang on, it's inflation busting. It's 8.5%. That wage rise is much more than inflation. Inflation's only 6.8% and it's falling. It's going to be lower. They're going to get an above inflation rise. It's like, yeah, that's what was baked into the triple lock. So I think that it's blindingly obvious from the annual argument about this, and also from the fact that both Rishi Sunak and Keir Starmer are very keen not to promise to keep the triple lock after the election and would rather totally dodge any questions on it whatsoever, that this is a tricky policy that needs fixing. So I think we need a double lock. I think that we need to ditch that wages element, which is obviously an issue, and we need to come up with a clear purpose. So what could the clear purpose be? Here's my idea, that we want to ensure a meaningful state pension rise and for pensioners to become slightly better off each year. And I think that getting back to a scenario where Britain's become steadily richer in real terms should be one of our main economic goals in this country, reversing the decline in real incomes. So in which case, the double lock should be the higher of inflation plus 1% or 3%, which is the inflation target plus 1%. And that's a simple concept.
Yeah.
You build a policy on it. It's the kind of guarantee that a government should be able to stick to. And it'll prove expensive, but maybe we think it's worth it. We all get a vote in the election. A party puts it forward. We vote on it. We decide whether we think it's there, whether we think it's a good idea. And if we do think it's a good idea, we then stick to it. We don't start trying to unpick the promise that we've made. I mean, others have got different ideas. Sam has a different idea. He thinks we should just uprate it by inflation. But I do think we need to have a proper, an honest debate about this that is not the kind of polarised taking sides and throwing things over the barricade one that we're having at the moment.
Wouldn't that be lovely, Simon? That seems politically quite easier to swallow than scrapping the whole thing, that's for sure. I mean, one thing, Sam, about all this is that the personal allowance that we get has been frozen until 2028. I think it was Evelyn Partners. They worked out that if the state pension rises by just 3%, bearing in mind it's gone up 10%, it could go up 8.5% next year, 3%, it would reach the personal allowance figure by 2027, which means you'd be paying income tax on your state pension. Well, I suppose that's a good thing for the government, in a way, giving it out, taking it back.
Well, I mean, this is it, and it's already happening. You know, hundreds of thousands of people do pay income tax, and I think there'll be another, I mean, again, assuming that 8.5% state pension rise in April of next year, there'll be another 600,000 people who are dragged into paying income tax on their pension. So the government kind of look at your state pension and any sort of private pension or annuity you've got, bundle it all together, look at the income from that, and if it goes over, this is a memory test now, the personal allowance, £12,570 a year. Basically, effectively, you start paying income tax on that. And what they've done is frozen that threshold at the same level it was last year. So any state pension increase, you know, especially the kind of one that we're talking about, whether it's 8.5% or whether it's slightly lower, you're still going to be dragging, you know, hundreds of thousands of pensioners into a situation where their weekly state pension, well, actually, not, that's not quite true. It's your private pension, effectively, that the tax gets taken from. But your weekly income from your pension is reduced. So, you know, and that's something which, again, it doesn't seem to be as hot a potato politically as any discussion to do with the triple lock, but it is still happening and it's still going to hit pensioners in the pocket. And actually, it's something that, if you know, I think more people should be aware of, because, you know, it does seem quite unfair that having worked all your life, built up a kind of a retirement pot, built up a private pension as well, that you're now in a position where, you know, you're paying income tax again. And if the state pension keeps on rising the way it has been rising, I mean, you know, I think in the next few years we'll probably get back to the position where it's more like a sub 5% rise every year, and that personal allowance stays the same or doesn't rise as quickly, you'll be getting into a position where people are paying income tax just based on the state pension, even if they have no private pension at all, which I think is a pretty sobering position to be in.
Indeed. Right, we're going to leave it there, because I'm pretty confident this subject will come round again and we can talk about it then. But talking about hitting people in the pocket, as you did there, Sam, around 65,000 people in the UK lost £37.5 million through Facebook Marketplace last year. Now, that's according to estimates from the High Street Bank TSB. Lloyds Bank reckon the number of purchase scams involving Facebook Marketplace has increased by 75% so far this year. But we know that this crime is wildly underreported. So could these figures just be the tip of the actual iceberg of how many people are really getting scammed online? So this is Money wanted to see how easy online trading sites such as Facebook Marketplace make it for scammers to set up fraudulent posts and scarper with the money. But before you tell me what you found, Facebook Marketplace, what is it? How does it work?
So if you're signed up to Facebook, obviously the social media platform, one of the services that they provide is Facebook Marketplace. And this is a way of buying and selling items. You know, I've done it. It is hugely convenient. And one of the big advantages is that it is free to list items and there are no fees for selling them. So unlike a platform like eBay, which is going to take a cut, there are also obviously millions and millions of people that use Facebook. And my experience of using Facebook Marketplace is that if you list something to sell, you're going to get potentially dozens of people messaging you, sometimes within the hour, and then the thing's gone by the end of the day. You know, someone comes around to your house, has a look, pays you the money, off they go. But you're right to say that the banks are all pointing the finger at Facebook and other social media platforms for scams online. They are right to do that, but it's very convenient for the banks to do that because it suits their purposes, because they have a very checkered approach to refunding scam victims where the victim has authorized the payment to the scammer. So the banks are very keen to point the finger at the social media platforms like Facebook, but actually I could argue they could be doing far more on what's called authorized push payment scams.
Yeah, be that as it may though, it is a huge proportion. I think it's something like 16% of all crimes reported to the police last year were related to Meta platforms, scams on things like WhatsApp, Instagram, Facebook. That is an extraordinary number. And as I said, Simon, scams tend to go, or frauds tend to go, underreported because people are quite ashamed of being in that position. But, you know, Facebook Marketplace, I'll be honest with you, I have stuff from it, not stuff I bought for myself, but other people, because I can't bring myself to go on something like that. Have someone come round to my house or me go there? Oh, I don't know. It just makes me a bit uncomfortable. But then, you know, I'm not with the times.
Well, I suppose that is with the times, really, isn't it? I mean, once upon a time, people wouldn't have thought of anything of just going around to someone's house and buying someone off something off
yeah,
them.
Maybe.
Someone coming around there and buying something off them. I think we live in less trustful times, don't we? Or more mistrustful times. I'm not sure. We're constantly being warned about all these dangers around the corner when actually, you know what? Most people are sound. And, you know, yeah. So you've got a used item that you want to sell and it's a quick and easy way to sell it and they come around and pick it up off you and vice versa, you know, it's okay. Yeah, there are bad actors out there, but there are bad actors in all kinds of things. And once upon a time, you would have just done it out of the classifieds in the back of the newspaper. I mean, that's effectively what this is. This is a new version of the little boxes in the back of the local newspaper where people would put things up for sale. It's just it's much easier and more user friendly, I guess. And also,
so the crime is
unfortunately those local newspapers have been
scale,
lost, killed
it?
Off. Yeah, it is, but it makes it very easy to rip people off. Mm. So you have to be have your wits about you, and make sure that you don't make it easy for you to be ripped off. I mean, I've bought things through Facebook Marketplace. I've sold things through Facebook Marketplace as well. One of the advantages of Facebook Marketplace is you get parts of it, you know, boards that are set up for certain things. So, for example, there's one where people buy and sell used snowboard gear, which is great, but it's a private group and you have to, you know, ask to join it that I've used before. And you know, it's not particularly difficult to join. You know, there's a number of these different groups and everything, but I found it quite useful. I got my daughter some snowboard boots through it. My wife bought some new snowboard boots through it, got a good deal from someone who didn't want them anymore. I've sold stuff through things like that. But I do think that you do have to be a bit careful. And then sometimes you have to just go, okay, I am very much taking this on trust. So for example, when my wife bought those snowboard boots off someone, they were 50 quid. They looked like they were in perfect condition. She asked for lots of photographs. The person sent them. They seemed to be in perfect condition. They looked like they could have come straight out of a box, brand new. But there came a point where that person had to send them to her and she had to transfer that person 50 quid.
Yeah.
And between those two things, you know, they might not turn up. You might not send the 50 quid. I mean, I think that this lady waited until the 50 quid was in her account. So, but you're definitely setting yourself up for the potential that you could lose some money. So you've got to go in that instance, all right, am I willing to take this risk that's probably only slight because this person's probably genuine, that I'm going to lose this £50 and go, okay, well, you know, that's fine. But there are people getting properly ripped off and properly defrauded of hundreds or thousands of pounds on Facebook Marketplace. And it is not accountable in any way when that happens.
Exactly. It's not accountable in any way. You know, as we found out with our recent investigation.
Tell me about that.
You know, well, so what we tried to do was work out how easy is it to set up as a, you know, in inverted commas, fraudulent seller, because obviously we didn't rip anybody off. Can we set up on Facebook Marketplace? You know, what's the verification process like? Can we, you know, it was kind of done in laboratory, you know, conditions. No one actually lost any money. We just wanted to test how simple it was. And it was the simplest thing in the whole world, you know, and really the issue with scams on Facebook Marketplace is that if you are defrauded, you fall down the cracks of a lot of systems that would either stop that fraud or refund you your money if you are scammed. So Facebook currently, as Simon says, has got no obligation to pay you if you lose any money to a marketplace scam. Many Facebook scammers, they will ask you to, you know, post items or for items to be posted to them, or they will ask for a deposit, for example, before you can come and pick an item up. Obviously, all of these things are red flags. Be very, very wary of that. Some of the fraudsters will ask you to pay them or pay this deposit, either using a kind of special link, maybe to a payment system you've never heard of, which will be very likely a fraud, or to pay them using something called PayPal Friends and Family. So anyone that signed up to PayPal, which is obviously, you know, millions upon millions of people, will know that there is an option to pay people called Friends and Family. And that is basically a way of making payments quickly without the kind of usual kind of bells and whistles and kind of fraud protection. I think it works as a Facebook Marketplace scam because Facebook Marketplace is quite friendly, it's quite chummy, it's quite informal. Often it's people that live in your area or down the road that are kind of buying and selling things. So when someone says, oh, do you mind paying me using PayPal friends and family? It's one of those things that sneaks under the radar a lot of the time. But the main important thing to remember about PayPal friends and family is that if you make a payment to someone who turns out to be a fraudster using that system, you have no scam refund protection at all. Then you get onto, you know, we're kind of looping back around now. Okay, well, the money has been lost. You know, I've transferred this money. It's gone from my bank account. Can I get the money back from my bank? And again, this is where 50% of the time you won't, because banks take the view that if you have authorized a payment to someone, even in good faith, and you've been tricked out of your money by a criminal, that's your fault. You know, 50% of the time, those frauds do not get refunded. And this is really, I think, what fraudsters trade on. And the kind of the real tragedy of it, people that do lose money on Facebook Marketplace, is that they find very often that they've got nowhere to go. They can go and register that fraud with the police, with Action Fraud, which is their the kind of fraud unit of the City of London Police, which is a nationwide initiative. But as we have reported on before and other titles have reported on, the chances of them actually taking any action on your fraud are very, very low. And the chances of you getting your money back are even lower. So yeah, I think there's something about the Facebook Marketplace frauds, which is particularly galling, because having lost the money, you then find that you've got no way of getting it back either.
Mm. It seems that the only winner here is Facebook. But are there any tips? Because, you know, it does seem to be, look, if the banks aren't going to help, Facebook aren't going to help. It is a great way to get, you know, a bargain, to stop so much waste going. You know, it's great if we can resell our items. What are your tips?
Yeah, so yeah, we shouldn't doom-monger too much. The vast majority of interactions on Facebook Marketplace are very innocent. You know, we're stopping items going to waste out into landfill. Broadly speaking, it is a very good thing to do. But there are a few kind of bits of best practice that we picked up when we were doing this marketplace investigation. So if you are a buyer, do not put any of your details on any kind of payment page which is sent to you by the seller, because a lot of fraudsters, what they're trying to do is get you off Facebook and onto another payment platform, which may steal your money or it may steal your personal information. So be very, very careful what form of payment you're being asked to use. Also, if you can, try to see the item in person first. Don't ever put a deposit down or pay in advance for an item that you then have to go and pick up. You know, regardless of what this person is trying to tell you, a lot of fraudsters are, you know, and we see this time and time again, extremely convincing and extremely clever. And especially on a platform like Facebook, where, as I said before, it's quite informal, it's quite chatty. You know, when you're having these kind of interactions between buyer and seller, very easy to have your guard brought down. Try and check out the person that you're buying from. You know, you'll be able to see when they list it, they will have a Facebook profile. You'll be able to go on there. Do they have feedback as a seller? Have they got friends on Facebook? You know, have they made other similar listings? If it looks like they've created a listing just to sell some items, be a bit wary of that, because again, that account could just disappear in a week. Again, don't be pushed into sending money to a seller because of the fear of missing out, to pressure you into a sale. That is one of the oldest tricks in the scammer's handbook. You know, create a sense of urgency, which causes your normal caution to dip. You know, someone's telling you, oh, well, you have to be quick because I've had five people message me about it this morning already. Things like that. They may be telling the truth, they might not, but don't do something that you wouldn't ordinarily do purely based on that sense of urgency. If you're a seller, again, there is a fraud risk to you, albeit a smaller one. Sometimes a fraudster will contact you pretending to be interested in something that you've listed. They might send you links to fill in extra information or requests for more information. Again, keep that to purely information about the item. Don't give away any personal information, because that has a value to, you know, in the criminal world. If you've got any concerns about the person that wants to buy the item, meet in a public place, make sure you're not alone. And likewise, if the buyer comes to your home, which is often how genuine transactions go on Facebook Marketplace, any concerns at all, make sure you're not alone in the house when that happens. If someone's offering you above the asking price, might be genuine, might just be someone that really wants that item, but it can then be followed up by oh, and by the way, can you post it? Can you do this? Can you do that? If something seems too good to be true, it often is. So be a bit wary of those people. And this is also quite a common fraud for sellers, is that someone will send you a screenshot as a kind of proof of payment. Look, I've transferred you the money to your bank account. Don't rely on that as any sort of proof. You know, obviously wait to make sure that the money is cleared at your end, it's landed in your bank account, then the item is kind of safe to deliver or post out.
Sound advice there, Sam. Sound advice. Right, that's it for part one.
Don't forget, you can stay on top of what's going on in the markets by tuning in to the Digest and Invest podcast by eToro. Go to your regular podcast platform and listen on the go. Digest and Invest by eToro, the podcast for those interested in trading and investing.
Welcome back. Santander has pulled its Best Buy Easy Access account a week earlier than planned due to high demand. Not a surprise, it was a whopping 5.2%. But of course, you already knew that because, like me, you've signed up to This Is Money's savings alert tool. And Simon, that is how I found out as well. So quick it was. Why Santander pulled it?
Because it proved to be very, very popular. It was an absolute humdinger of a savings account. Blowing the easy access competition out of the water. 5.2%, you get that rate for a year, then it was going to drop to a lowly rate, but we have to make do is make sure that you jump ship at that point. No limits on how many withdrawals you can make. A lot of easy access accounts nowadays aren't really easy access because they're easy access, triple access or something like that. You can only take money out three times a year. So it was fantastic. And it arrived last week with the promise that it would be on sale until the 17th of September. The hint that this was not long for this world was in the name, the limited edition, and the fact that they said it would only be on sale until the 17th of September, unless it proved very popular. And obviously it did prove very popular and they've pulled it. And this is great for Santander because Santander has managed to get a ton of publicity off the back of this and a ton of articles, a ton of people talking about it. Yeah. Not one, but two savings alerts out to all of our readers who have cleverly signed up to the savings alerts, more on which in a minute with a shameful plug. And reams and reams of, you know, column inches on its savings account. And it hasn't even had to have it around for the full length of its life. So, you know, well done then for offering it in the first
How
place.
How much is there right now? How much is there right now for an easy access at Santander?
2.5
or something. So yes, it's something very,
very
low.
I'm not sure. Yeah. It introduced another like real blockbuster savings account back when savings rates were much, much lower last year with this 2.75% one that it did that lots of people got very excited about and signed up to. But it said that people with those accounts could just open this new one and then switch their money over quite easily, which there were no limits on taking the money out of the first one anyway, so obviously they could do. But it was I know people who did this, and it was a very seamless process, which is quite good because banks and builder societies can sometimes make it quite a lot harder than it should be to open their better account.
So I mean, just a quick one. With easy access accounts, how does it work? So you get a rate of 5.2%, for example, and you put a whack of money in, and then you want to put regular money into that account. But now that the figure has dropped, does that mean any money you put in afterwards gets at the lower rate, or do you have it committed for a year?
No. The way that this account works, because it was this limited edition on sale for only a certain amount of time only thing, it's offered to pay a rate of 5.2% on balances of up to £250,000 for 12 months. So if you open that account and you put money in and you put any new money in, even the money that you put in on the 364th day will earn that higher rate of interest. Won't earn much because it'll only earn the interest for a day. But you will get that higher rate. It's not that the money that you put in before midnight on Tuesday, he says, trying to remember what day of the week it is. It's not that you were only going to get that rate on that money, and then any more money that you put in, you get the lower rate on. That would make it a bit of a rubbish deal and not the kind of one that we would necessarily savings alert people to. Going back to our savings alert, did I mention we've got savings alerts?
Maybe once, I think.
Right, okay. So here's the deal. What we have is a special savings alert system, and we email readers to let them know about the best savings rates as they land. Now, as these top deals land, the ones that we think are really, really good, we get a story up as quickly as we possibly can because we want our readers to know about them. And some of these things don't stick around for long, so you need to know about them. They don't usually go in 30 minutes, but, you know, we do our best. And then if you're signed up to our savings alert service, we will send you an email and you will know straight away that Santander has a great new 5.2% Best Buy account. Mm-hmm. And to do this, to sign up to this, you go to thisismoney.co.uk/alert. And you can join the other, I think, 17,000 people who know exactly when there's a really great, really great new savings deal. And also, as part of this service, you can get warned if someone is about to remove a really great service deal, because Santander let us know this week that that account is closing at midnight. So up went the story from Helen Crane and out went the alert warning our readers that they needed to act before midnight to open this account and lock into this great rate. Otherwise, they were going to have to be mixing it with the more lowly contenders in the best savings rates tables, the best of which is now Synergy Bank, which pays 5.9%, followed by Oxbury, which pays 4.94%. So, you know, still a decent rate, but not higher than 5%.
No.
Well, I mean, 5% is equal to 5%, but it's not higher than 5%.
No, exactly. Thank you very much, Simon. So do sign up to that. And finally, reader question time. A person after my own very indecisive heart who is struck by decision paralysis on buying their first home. They've been to see about 40 properties. You've got to give it to their commitment for that one. But no closer to the goal are they. So, Sam, what on earth should they do? You've been speaking to the experts. What have they told you?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very mixed bag. And I think it's one of those situations where if you've seen 40 homes, you've got the deposit. I think probably what we're looking at is a situation where you're looking for the perfect home, but it doesn't exist. You know, there is no perfect home. You know, I think if you can afford a deposit, I would argue it is better to be on the ladder with a slightly imperfect home than start renting. And the reader that we've kind of been speaking to for this article, obviously what they're concerned about is, oh, I don't want to buy the wrong thing. House prices are really high. You know, what if house prices go down? What if mortgage rates go down? You know, it is absolutely impossible to time the market. And even if you give it a go and you pick the right time, you know, so many things can go wrong to cause a house sale to drag out or even fall through. This is a very personal decision. You know, there is a huge cost of buying a house. I would also argue if you are renting, there is also a huge and growing cost to that too. Yeah. There's also a cost to house viewing, whereas your monthly mortgage payment, if you are on the ladder, is effectively going into a savings account with your name on it rather than a landlord's pocket. So, you know, if I were in that position, and I think this is kind of, you know, the sort of distilled kind of view of some of the experts that we spoke to, it is probably better to swallow some of your concerns and get something that is about 90% right for you, rather than looking for that absolute 10 out of 10 home. And maybe it will come along later in your life.
Yeah. To me, this seems more of a psychology question than it does actually a house. Because if you've got to 40 houses, that is, I think you need to start sort of really thinking about the way that you do things. Right. That's it. You can keep up to date with all the latest Breaking Money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions to the team, anything you'd like them to look into, Simon?
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk and tell us if you viewed more than 40 houses. Perhaps you viewed 60, you know, and you can tweet us at thisismoney, and you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to find all podcast past and join the debate in reader comments.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
Don't forget, you can stay on top of what's going on in the markets by tuning in to the Digest and Invest podcast by eToro. Go to your regular podcast platform and listen on the go. Digest and Invest by eToro, the podcast for those interested in trading and investing.